And you're on The Postman Show, and that's www.thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. We got that right after several dyslexic moments. And our guest today is actually a fellow dyslexic, Graham Axford. Hi, Graham, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, thank you.
We're actually not going to be talking about dyslexia, KO. We're going to be talking about the Pike River, but just before we get into that, just a couple of housekeeping issues. The first one is, if you want to find out basically or listen to the podcast, instead go to their website, thevinnyeastwoodshow.com, or you can go to my Facebook page, which is Ben Vidgen, V-I-D-G-N. We have, again, in fact, it's just easy to go to the website. There's a link for the Investigate channel. It's actually up there. We're doing the show today on Pike River, but I'm hoping next week to be doing a show on the Ebola virus. This is going to be a very interesting show because what I've actually done is I've gone back and I've retrieved an article I wrote in 2009, which I put on Alexander Constein's Black Watch website. Interestingly enough, every time you try to get into that site, they put up all sorts of security warnings and you post it up on Facebook, they don't like it. So that's a good indication that I'm onto some good material. Basically, we looked, it was written before the crash of MH17 and MH370 and the Ebola virus. So I think when you read it, you'll find a lot of things in that very, very interesting. I've also forwarded another little piece on it, which is called Adopt Deaths, where what I've basically done is I've traced the recent outbreak of Ebola in Africa, and I look at five key factors which I believe indicate that this shows that this is a weaponized virus. I have also turned around and I've looked at an event that happened in 2010 where the anthrax virus appeared in Pakistan, a Pacific strain, the AIM strain, which is the same, and we are talking literally the same strain that emerged in the US and Pakistan in 2001. This was linked back to Fort Detrick, who emerges very much as a key player in all of this outbreak in West Africa. And what we also look at there is the fact that the key suspect for the person that was believed to be responsible for this event in 2001, he actually died in 2006. So to have this virus then emerge again in Pakistan in 2010 is a very telling sign that our serial killer is still loose. And in actual fact, this guy may be the very person that's advising the US Center for Disease on how to deal with this. So you know, the guy that's actually helping them out is the guy that may have caused it. I'll also be linking that to the South Africa's role in bioengineering and genocide. Many, many, many well-documented cases where they literally carried out genocide in Africa. My favourite one, but the one that horrifies the most is where they injected prostitutes with HIV, released them into villages, and then literally let them loose in the villages. A lot of the key people in that project you can tie up very much in Fort Detrick's, which is the source of the anthrax virus in 2001, and a lot of those key people we can see are still on the board, as it were. So that should be an interesting show. I'm hoping to probably do that in about two shows, and I'm hoping to get some really, really good guests, some basically world-caliber people who are, I'm sure you'll know their names, or at least you recognise the university that's involved, and I'll be working very hard to make that happen in the next couple of weeks. So do stay tuned. However, we are going to come back a little backwards, and we're going to focus on an event a little bit closer to home, which is the Pike River event, which occurred in 2010 when the Pike River Greymouth had its disaster and 29 individuals were trapped. And what we're going to do today is we're going to fast forward, because we all know these 29 individuals were trapped down there. And what kind of brought my attention to this, to go and actually have a closer look at it, was when they interviewed Marty Palmer on the Campbell Live show, and in 5:35, and it's, the tube's available on YouTube, at 5:35 he turns around and he makes the point that, you know, they want to send guys down there not just to retrieve the bodies, in fact they make clear that they may not be able to retrieve all of them, but that they'll also be able to retrieve equipment which has essential data which actually will be able to turn around and tell them how this happened and who is responsible. Very, very key factor. I mean, everyone's always been thinking about that's going down there's just for the guys, but no, this is actually going to solve a lot of unanswered questions. And I turned around on my Facebook page when I first looked at this, and I turned around and I basically turned around and I said the following. As I mentioned, the whole Marty Palmer thing, and why? And then I started to say, why is Solid Energy so determined to reject this offer, to send men down to get equipment? I mean, these are volunteers. They're basically doing their own fundraising. All the experts say that this is only possible, so the only people that say that it's not possible, Solid Energy. And I said, you know, why is this so determined to reject this offer? Campbell Lai points out the expert studies that can be done basically mean we shouldn't be either, you know, it's either it can't be done, in which case we shouldn't be mining at all, or it can be done, in which case Solid Energy, why are you so reluctant to actually to turn around and actually have this occurred? I then turned around, you know, sort of just to familiarise myself, I actually went and read the Royal Commission on the Pike River Coal Mining Tragedy, Volume 1. I won't read you the whole material because it's just too long-winded, and that's kind of my whole point. You read the whole introduction about why it occurred, and you're actually left with the conclusion that it doesn't tell you what actually happened. It talks about cultural potential equipment failure. There is actually no actual reason given to why this occurred. However, you know, I started to look at this whole situation of electrical and it made me think, well, you know, let's just do a little bit of research and see what I can find out about Pike River and the electrics and the whole place. I just did, and this is in 15 seconds of Googling, and the words electrical and Pike River, we have the words come up repeatedly in the commission by the witnesses, the unorthodox electrics in the mine. We have mining expert Tony Resnick, and my pronunciation on that may not be 100% correct, said, told the Royal Commission that Pike River knew it had problems with its electrics and the mine should have been shut down until it was resolved. Resnick believed that the main ventilation could have also ignited the explosion. Pike River was thought to be the only coal mine worldwide that has a fan installed underground in a gassy environment difficult to properly maintain. Resnick told the commission that to make the mine safe would have been required major changes, which would have been hugely expensive and inconvenient. So, in other words, they put these men's life ahead of expense. Recollection of the official time the explosion occurred from witness Daniel Rockholz told the injury he was working underground in the mine on November 19th when he saw a white flash from the corner of his eye. It was a boom and it hit me and it happened in milliseconds. All these factors produced 10 questions which I hope to answer on the show today, or at least get quite a long way into it. What time did the mine's electrician Russell Smith enter the mine on whose orders? What investigation occurred, if any, of monitoring equipment above or below ground, of changes in the atmosphere, or any other related safety equipment, including equipment related to the ventilation and the build-up of methane? What was the precise purpose of the mine electrician Russell Smith going down into the mine as an electrician at this time? Why did Smith enter the mine alone at this time and not as part of a normal shift rotation? And that's a very interesting point because I think you're going to find that some porkies have been told. 5. If there was an electrical fault at the time or a recorded rise in methane levels, why was work not stopped? 6. Was the mine aware of previous issues concerning ventilation equipment? 7. Was this fault, if identified, related to performance of the mine ventilation system? What was the proposed solution in relation to impact on mine safety caused by such equipment failure? 9. What does the mine in-house monitored equipment say regarding performance of electrics atmosphere, including the ventilation equipment, before and during the Rockhouse assignment and the explosion in the Pike River? And 10, where would you expect to find records, documentation, sources in relation to the above 9 questions? And on that note, Graham, how are you doing?
Jolly good. And you?
I'm doing very well. A few little electrical technical issues of our own, but we got here in the end. Graham, before we kind of get too much into kind of discussing these issues, and I was just explaining, I was talking to you beforehand, like this show has great relevance to me as well because my great-great-grandfather was actually a miner at Denison and I've had a lot of attachment to the West Coast. I was actually over there about 4 months ago doing some research for a book project and this is one of the things that I will actually be covering in my book as well. But Graham, what's your own connection to this event?
Well, my family has a long family history right back to the Strongman mine disaster where an uncle was killed, and my father was actually a coal miner. He started off at Rewanui and he ended up at Strongman. This was after the disaster, and he was also became a deputy and a shot firer as well. So Dad was aware of all the risks, and that's why when the Marty Palmer video came on Facebook, Campbell Live or whatever it was, Dad heard it and Dad said the guy's exactly right. Because one of the things that everybody's missed is they're actually going to enter the drift of the mine, not the mine itself. So it's actually a lot safer. Entering the actual mine itself is potentially a lot more dangerous.
And that's the point that we're talking about. I mean, they're not talking about going fully into their fully expensive, highly dangerous operation. They're talking about basically going into the start of the mine, which is where a lot of that key equipment is available, which is going to really kind of sort out what did go on, isn't it?
Well, yes, and see, one of the big confusing things for a lot of the old timers around here who were miners is when it first blew, they went and pumped oxygen down the mine, and no one could understand why they did that, because potentially you're setting that up for another few explosions, because after an explosion is actually the safest time to enter a mine, but of course they weren't allowed to, and thus this is why it's been such a protracted thing, because they've had to bring the mine under control with the gases and all the rest of it before they could consider re-entering the drift.
So to get that right, basically they could have sent. I mean, this is standard operating procedure. That soon after is the best time to send them in. They didn't do that, so they breached that normal protocol, and then they pumped oxygen into it, which actually could have caused a second explosion, which is basically what actually happened. So they literally poured gasoline on the fire, as it were.
Oh, absolutely. That's the way that a lot of the old-time miners see it.
I'm looking at the situation when it goes talking about the real time. I mean, this is what it says about the ventilation system. Real-time gas monitoring system included sensors that hadn't been working for nearly 2 months before the explosion. Another that it wasn't properly calibrated, and others stated that it produced variables in inaccurate information. Moreover, Pike had not installed a tube bundle monitoring system, standing kit, in underground coal mines, which would have provided much more detailed information about gas levels, including methane concentrations up front. So, not only did they not carry out the right protocols, but after the event, they were basically running equipment that was fairly unsafe and ignoring the standard operating procedures then as well, weren't they?
Oh, absolutely. And see, the thing is with a lot of that electrical stuff is there may be deviances from what we actually know, because they sourced equipment from all over the place. So it's quite possible that what we think we know now could prove to be different if they actually get into the mine and have a look, and that's where the problem lies.
I just want to focus on that point for a second, because and this is where I'm going to be upfront. My technical, I've never been in a mine. I wouldn't know the difference between a coal mine and a gold mine. But what I would like sort of logically to think is that a mine of that type is a highly technological operation. It's very sophisticated. There's lots of material. I'm going back to that point when they talk about Daniel Rockhouse talking about the scene, that explosion. I'm assuming that lots of equipment at that time would be literally shared, destroyed, but in doing so, that would give you literally the time that the clock stopped is going to turn around and tell you exactly what time this occurred, isn't it?
Well, in theory, yeah. It's just like when a house burns down and everyone looks at it and says there's no way the fire department could know how that started. There's always signs for those who have the experience and the knowledge. And so we do believe there is evidence down there, and there'll be enough evidence to actually give a more clearer indication about everything. Because at the moment, it's only guesswork.
Well, exactly, and this is and I want to get into that, but just again to clarify that the guesswork basically states that the explosion occurred at 3:40, and it was around about 4 o'clock, give or take, for some variation, that basically up top knew what was going on. They contacted the authorities, who didn't arrive for another 2 hours. Am I painting that picture accurately?
There is differing views, but I believe what you've said is the more plausible one of everything we've heard.
Well, that's the one that I'm pulling from the Royal Commission, and I guess that's another interesting point too, because one of the things I found really interesting when I started to research this, and I'm gonna over time get into this a bit deeper, and it's unfortunately when you're an independent, there's only limited resources you can spend on any given day on any subject, and I've normally got my hand in about 4 or 5 topics. But when you are looking at this, what struck me was very basic facts. You'd read one newspaper article, and it would, for example, one moment Daniel Rockhouse is the electrician, the next moment it's Russell Smith. I mean, very basic stuff. The media couldn't get it right, and it became very frustrating to actually ascertain what was going on, because it almost was like that the person that they'd sent to monitor the royal inquiries was falling asleep half the time and just said, I think that's what my notes say.
Well, yeah, that is the whole problem, is there's so much stuff that contradicts and inconsistencies, and like you said, to go through them reports is harrowing. I mean, that they're too big, the average person can't read them, and as you've said, it doesn't actually specifically say what the cause of the explosion was. So you're floundering all over the place trying to actually piece it together, and you can't.
Well, let's kind of go back to those moments, and we're falling on this is on the theory that, give or take, at around the 3:30, 3:40 mark, that Russell Smith, who the electrician, was sent into the mine. Now, they're saying that he was sent in there to examine communication failures and electrician failures. The first thing is, how exactly is an electrician going to fix a communication failure?
Well, I mean, I honestly don't know. And that's the other thing, is that they haven't exactly explained things like that to the average person either.
Well, they haven't explained them at all. I mean, this is when you go in to look about when they went in. They don't. I mean, this is the thing. Where can you find information saying what was the electrician failures that he was actually going in to investigate?
Yeah,
isn't that a glaring, obvious question? It's like, well, if it was there to fix the lights in the toilets, surely that should be written in a report or a job sheet somewhere that says, you know, before you go down, you write so-and-so, we're sending him down to fix the toilets and the men's toilets. Where's that documentation?
Well, that is a very good question. And another thing to point out is, I believe that there were people who were around when this was happening at the time, and they haven't been interviewed.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm kind of slightly jumping ahead of myself, but of course the other issue is, you know, why did Russell Smith himself not actually appear as a witness?
Yeah, I agree. That would be one of the basic things you would expect.
I mean, and I'll get into that a little bit, because there is a devil's advocate argument, but it's a pretty shallow one. But, okay, so far we've got going in to fix equipment, but no reason stated what equipment it will, and no explanation why an electrician's fixing communication equipment. And we have him going down there with, as you know, not explaining why he's actually going down there. Now, according to this, to the official line, and this is the game, the Inquirer report and everything that we see in the mainstream newspapers, Rockhouse, the flash occurs, he comes across Mr. Smith unconscious. He then tries to call up the authorities. And the time frame we're given for this is at that 3:30, 3:40 mark. Now, according to the Royal Inquiry, we're told that occurred at that time frame, and that originally they rang and they could only get an answer machine, and that was it. But yet, when you actually look in the Beehive, or as I did in the Beehive's material, it's quite fascinating, because what it actually states there is that, just bear with me 1 second, it states that basically he went in, here we are, at 1 p.m. It states he went in to fix this problem at 1 p.m. Now that's 3 hours before the explosion occurred. But it gets better, because it says Mr. Smith was also in C crew. So I'm assuming there must be other people who would have gone down with him. So where are those people? And why? Who are they? And can we please find them? Because they're probably really important people to interview. He first says, Mr. Smith was also in C crew. He had missed the bus to the mine and was late for the 1 p.m. start of the shift. He was driving into the mine when the explosion struck. Minutes before he'd passed McConnell Dowell, drift heading out by, so minutes beforehand. So there's one, Dowell McConnell. He received no warnings before there was a flash of bright light and a deafening noise, followed by a shockwave. The pressure was unrelenting, and in an attempt to escape it, Mr. Smith lowered himself to gain protection with the cabin of the vehicle. As breathing became difficult, he attempted to remove a self-rescuer from his belt, but it was in an awkward position and could not. Now, again, this is a difficulty, because even as I'm reading this, I'm going, well, is this Mr. Smith or Mr. Rockhouse that they're talking about? There seems to be some really shoddy paperwork going on, but, you know, it says in the parliamentary version he went in at 1 p.m. But it gets better than that, because it carries on, and this is the report, so either they've got their names terribly wrong or they're doing it deliberately, but it says, after a minute or two, he's come across Mr. Smith, and it carries on. Daniel Rockhouse looked for a telephone. Just in by of his loaders, he located telephone 353 and rang the emergency number, 555. The telephone rang, but no one answered. Before the call was diverted to an answering service, he then dialed 410, the control room number. Stop. We're told in all the newspaper articles and an inquiry that he only rang one number and got no reply. Yet here we've got him actually ringing the control room, and it carries on. Mr. Duggan answered the phone. Daniel Rockhouse said he was not injured, but that he could not see or breathe. At this point, Mr. Wild took the telephone and was told that the air seemed to be... Now, I want to go back to that point. Daniel Rockwood said he was not injured, but that he could not see or breathe. At that point, Mr. White took the telephone, was told that the air seemed to be clearing, and instructed Daniel Rockhouse was told to stay low, get to the FOP about 500 metres. This is a huge significant finding, because for starters, we've just shown the fact that actually somebody did answer. Now, here's another little point. I've got a real gem up here, because this is actually very dynamite text. Graham, what do you think about that?
Oh, look, none of it makes sense. I agree with you.
So, you know, as I said, they've been telling us very specifically that they rang this number and that they only got an answer machine. But yet in the parliamentary reports, it says that actually they rang another number and that someone actually answered. Now, we're also told repeatedly in the inquiry reports and the media reports that basically the reason why Mr. Smith never testified was because he couldn't remember, because according to this, Daniel Rockhouse was unconscious for the significant period, perhaps 50 minutes or so after the explosion, blah, blah, blah. Well, this timeline's not making sense, because, and we're also told that previous elsewhere that Mr. Smith was unconscious and only woke up in the ambulance afterwards. Yet, if you go back to this report, it said after a minute or two of breathing fresh air and resuming, Daniel Ross, where were you saying? No, I'm going to set the point. But the key point, I'm just going to carry on with that key point there, is that basically they told us that there was no communication, that there was an answer machine. Yet here in this parliamentary report, which doesn't appear in the Royal Inquiry findings, you've actually got the fact that's a glaring lie. But, of course, the other question is, assuming that the control house got this information, and we accept, because bear in mind that their chief witness has suddenly got a case of amnesia and can't remember for perhaps 50 minutes, so we've only got their word to believe it at this stage. But yet, surely when you ring 111, which is what would have happened in the control room, that gets logged somewhere. So where again is the documentation showing when exactly that 111 call was made?
Yeah, and I agree.
So what we've got is a total absence of a paper trail, which in itself is a telling sign. So basically, there should be material to vindicate what they're saying here, but this material is interestingly enough absent. Meanwhile, the key witness is also absent. It doesn't look good, does it?
Well, no, a lot of it certainly doesn't add up.
So tell me something. Has any money been offered? I mean, first of all, just to clarify, has Key indicated that he will recover the bodies? Has any money been actually offered to make this available? And if so, what's actually happened to that money?
Right. First of all, I've just got to say that I can't speak for the families, because they've got their own spokesperson, which is Bernie Monk. But generally, from what I can understand, and I know about as much as the general public, is there was about $10.5 million offered for the potential re-entry of the mine, and I think off memory they've possibly spent about $7 million of that. But that was always based upon safety concerns being met, and I gather that WorkSafe New Zealand and Mine Rescues are saying getting into the drift isn't a problem. But Solid Energy seemed to be hinging on an issue, and the issue seems to be around a second exit strategy. So what they're saying is that they want another tunnel basically bored, so that they have a second option for getting out. That's what I believe they're saying. I can't be sure, because as usual, there's mixed messages from what's been put in the public arena. I'm only going by what's been said publicly, because I haven't at all spoken to the families about this. Well, so that seems to be the point of contention, as Marty pointed out on that interview he did.
I mean, it's a very good point, and I said, you know, it's a very good point, and that basically what we're seeing is a series of delay and delay after delay, while they turn around and tell us one set of information, and then they pause and then say another information, and so you just end up with a total confusion. Would that be a bit fair?
Yes, it would be fair, and as Bernie Monk said one day, if the mine is unworkable, then they should hand back the mining licence if they say they can't get into the mine.
And on that point, we'll come back to what the people of Greymouth think themselves shortly. In the meantime, you're on The Postman Show, and that's podcasting on the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, and we'll see you shortly. And you're on the Postman Show, and that's the podcast is available at www.thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Just a little bit of housekeeping. If anyone's listening into this and they like what they're hearing and they want to help out, best thing to do is get in contact with me. My Facebook site's actually on the website there. And if you've got a used smartphone that you're not using, that'll be really great because it'll help us in terms of doing these shows. We do them via Skype. I don't use a smartphone because I'm not smart enough, but I do need one. So if you want to contribute, otherwise there is a donation page and you're more than free to turn around and donate to that because at the end of the day, this is what I do for a livelihood. And it takes a huge amount of time and resources to do. And if you do feel like being part of the course, go and have a look at the website, and even a little will go a long way, but I will leave that entirely up to you. My guest today is Graham Axford, Graham, just before we get back into this, I understand you're dyslexic.
Very.
Me too. It annoys the hell out of me because quite often on Facebook, I mean, it's okay in print because I use, you know, proof editors and subs and they do it all, but when you're doing things on Facebook at 2 o'clock in the morning, you can't help but be dyslexic, and it always annoys me the number of people that will get on board and instead of dealing with what you're talking about, they want to actually talk about your commas and full stops, and you go, we live in the age of texting, get over it, people. But I mean, you know, for you, you've had a bit of issues in terms of you applying for a job as a social worker, and what was the deal there?
Well, I applied for a job as a social worker under a program called Mainstream, which is subsidised employment.
Yeah.
And I went to Child, Youth and Family, of all people, because I am a qualified social worker.
Yeah.
And to be honest, that didn't at all end well for me.
Yes, dyslexia is one of those things that gets, you know, it's you know, you've got two legs and two limbs, so people think it's all assumed, so there isn't really a lot that's actually out for us, so we just have to soldier on. But we do, you know, Julius Caesar was a dyslexic and so was Albert Einstein, and so am I. But let's get back to the issue of Pike River. I'm going to, like, what we turn around in the first part of the show is I focus on basically the issue of the ventilation shaft, the communication equipment, which should be able to provide details in terms of what time events actually occurred. And this will be very significant because the Royal Inquiry doesn't actually really state what the cause of the accident was. What I find quite interesting about this thing, Graham, is that the way that the media covered it was initially they came into town and they, you know, made a big fuss about it, and then they just basically walked away from it.
Yeah, and that's the way that a lot of people around the area actually see it. It's because the pressure still needs to be maintained on the Solid Energy Board or the government, who's actually technically their bosses,
yeah,
to get into that mine. And they seem to be the Solid Energy Board, which seems to be the whipping boy in all of this, and the government's excuse for saying, well, it's not our problem, are dragging the chain quite a bit.
See, my understanding is a bit twofold about this, which is, and this is not something, I mean, interestingly enough, on my Facebook page so far, I've only had three people turn around and criticise what I've actually posted up. Two of them have actually turned out to be young nationals. And of course, you know, this is a government that was using a blogger, Cameron Slater, who's going around calling West Coasters feral. So, you know, it doesn't really inspire a lot of confidence national, and that's the culture that's actually out there, which is basically West Coast, you're on your own, we don't care. But my understanding basically is twofold, is that both under Labor and National, the policy has been effectively mines can self-regulate themselves, and it's also gone to this whole issue of collective unionisation. So effectively, if you've got a mine that regulates itself and doesn't have to worry about unions because it's basically if you sign up to a union, you don't get the job, that's not a healthy or safe future that the West Coast can look forward to, is it?
Well, no, and the interesting thing is that Labor were actually looking at making changes to the, I think it was a Minings Act, which potentially would have made the mine slightly more safer. I'm certainly not saying that that would have been the silver bullet, but it would have been better than what we had got now.
Well, it's, I mean, you know, this is what struck me on a lot of these reports that I read, was that, you know, there's this issue of how when my great-grandfather went up to Denison, it was a hell of an environment. You're talking about a place which was in cloud level for 360 days a year. I mean, the woman that lived in that environment, it was horrendous to think what they put actually up. And there were, you know, lots of disasters. And we went for the 1930s and then the 1951, the workers' strike. And even by that stage, with all those improvements, we saw the strongmen occurred in 1961. I believe you had family involved in that.
Correct, yep.
So we through the 70s and leading up to the early 80s, there were huge improvements made in work safeties, which, you know, not only did they improve the safety of the men, but they actually increased the productivity of the mines. And then after the 80s, which, of course, when ergonomics came in, we've seen a complete slide backwards where basic maintenance, I mean, you know, the comment that comes out time and time again is all the Australians and the South Africans say, you wouldn't be able to get away with this in a mine in South Africa, or you wouldn't be able to get away with this in a mine in Australia. What's happened?
Oh, it just simply comes down to the feasibility of it all. It's about money over people.
But this is what I still don't quite understand, because, you know, when you look at it's this thing of, you know, they're putting money before people, but it's actually not helping their productivity as well. And a lot of these, you know, means that are actually out, that are in there, put in there for safety, also obviously keep the mine actually operating, which obviously means that you don't have to spend millions and millions of dollars afterwards, which is, you know, this is exactly, you know, that you would have thought that the Pike River was an exact reason to why collective unionisation should be protected, and also an exact reason as to why we should be making sure that regulation isn't left up to the mining industry itself.
Well, see, that's where the interesting thing is. Some of the stakeholders and shareholders of Pike got paid out because of the insurance. But talking about money, the Royal Commission of Inquiry cost about $10 million. So far, they've budgeted $10 million for the re-entry plan, and I can guarantee you that's going to go up.
I'm going to stop you there too, because, you know, when I've been looking at the re-entry plan, like, as far as I can actually see, they really actually haven't done that much, but a lot of that money has actually already gone. So the question is, to who and what do they do for it?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think we're getting back to the same issue as about the self-regulation, and that it's bureaucracy gone mad again.
Well, it just seems to me, and the same thing we see in the Christchurch earthquake, is that, you know, they bring out this money to look after the people that are, you know, in need, and yet it actually ends up going into the pockets of the people that very largely are responsible for the screw-ups or the failure to put in protocols appropriate for the event.
Well, that's exactly right. And the longer this goes on, my dad spent a long time in mining, and he said there's certain weather conditions you need which make it more safer than other times to enter the drift. And we've missed quite a few cycles of what we consider to be the most desired time to go into the mine. So again, more delays.
It just really strikes me that, you know, it's okay. I mean, let's turn around and let's say, put a figure. I'm picking a figure out of my head. You put $40 million into recovering these men and these equipment into that area. I'm going to tread very carefully here, but number one, you're showing the people of the West Coast that you care about them, and that should be, you know, when you go down to the mine, it should be a prerequisite that you know that if something happens to you, that at least someone's going to come and get you. You know, I mean, that's I always thought, even, you know, as a townie, that was a fundamental understood that of our mining culture. You know, it was leave no one behind. We also know that, you know, at the moment, you know, when I went through Greymouth, I was absolutely struck by 5 o'clock at night time. The place is a ghost town. I was struck by how many empty shops are in that place, and you collectively add to all the other issues that the closing of the cement works. This is a place that's actually suffering. You know, maybe a little bit of support would actually be a really helpful thing for them right now.
Well, that's exactly right, because they've raped and pillaged our resources over the years and made a lot of money out of the West Coast, and still do. And yet, on the other hand, when it comes to giving some of that back, they're very reluctant to.
Well, again, this is the whole thing that strikes me really nuts. And I know this is branching actually out, but, you know, I look at the West Coast, and there's about a zillion different things I can actually think of that you can turn around and stimulate the economy of the West Coast. But one of them, I also look at the whole issue of 1080, spray. And I go, I do the calculations. I go, we spend $600 million in 10 years, which is $60 million a year, on buying 1080. And that includes the West Coast government. I think you'll have to correct me, but one of the local West Coast bodies investing in a $500 million factory to make 1080. Wouldn't it be better to turn around and actually spend that money or at least a large percentage? Because there are some areas where I think, you know, I'm talking about 1% as opposed to the 100% we're doing now. There are some areas way up in the areas that you probably need 1080 until some other better solutions occurred, because you just can't get in there. But there are plenty of other areas where you could be using trained trappers to go out there, get the possums and the rats and the stoats, good money in possum fur. Dogs love possum meat, so there's another secondary industry you can make, you know, pet food. This is a solution where money's been actually offered up, but then coming back into the economy versus 1080, where all it does is takes that money actually out. What, you know, why is it so hard for them to create a stimulus package that'll actually create jobs on the West Coast?
Well, I mean, that was a very argument about when they stopped the forestry, which we believe was sustainable. They just shut it down, and that was it, and gave us $120 million, which has really not done us a lot. But
one of the other things that was pointed out to me when I was down there, I was talking to, you know, I mean, I've got a festival the West Coast. I'm an avid outright greenie, but, you know, my attitude is I will try and find solutions that keep food on the table than just turn around and say, don't chop down trees or don't mine. Because, you know, as I'm sitting here on Skype with my cell phone, my iPads, you know, this stuff all came from mining. So to say don't mining is ridiculous. We've got to find solutions that we can reduce that impact and also find alternatives. That if you don't want people to do this, then give them some other way to keep a job. And, you know, I look at the situation and I go, what I understood with the issue of the timber situation was when that went through, they were actually challenged on this. So the government actually retrospectively, not only did they actually change the law retrospectively to cover them, which became the precedent on this whole, you know, we see now John Key changing the law when he found out that 80 people were spying on New Zealanders, but then they made the law so it actually became illegal, in fact, an act of treason to sue your own government.
Correct. And, yeah, there's always these – the West Coast has always seemed to be worse off. We seem to be – everyone wants to lock the West Coast up because there's about 87% of land that's locked up and dock don't pay rates. So we're actually – the West Coasters are subsidising the dock land that everyone wants to keep that we're paying for.
Which is, you know, I mean, you know, that's one issue. And I've got my own word for the Department of Conservation, and the nice word isn't a nice word. But, you know, I think to myself, well, okay, we want to keep these trees available, or we want to, you know, restrict the number of mining. Well, you know, in an age of the internet, why don't we turn around and make sure that the West Coast has got good internet connections so that then people can be saying, well, actually, I'm an IT and I can actually live on the West Coast and do my job from a house that's, you know, a huge house for $200,000 and have my family and not worry about crime, as opposed to living in Auckland where I have to buy virtually a $1 million house, drive several hours and still get, you know, why not turn around and create, use that modern technology to give the West Coast a bedrock so that we can actually have our cake and eat it too. Look after the environment, put food on the table. Is it that hard?
Well, you see, that's the thing. As the West Coasters say, we try not to shit in our own nest. So if they were, we need to, now a lot of people agree that if they could, they would get out of mining. They would get out of all of these destructive environmental things. But we have no alternative at the moment, and that is where the problem is.
Well, I mean, you know, and that's, I mean, you're right. My impact is, you know, when I travel through the West Coast, and I'm a bit of a freak, I actually like to hitchhike through the West Coast because it's great. You always get picked up. You get take on these amazing adventures. People always throw amazing food at you. But you also get to talk to a lot of people. And that's what I did was I talked to hunters, Department of Conservation workers, farmers, tourist operators. And, you know, what I was struck by was how everybody from miners onwards love the West Coast. It's got so many opportunities to, from the wild food to create, you know, new forms of tourism to the gold mining history of tourism. These are all things that collectively, not one single answer, but collectively, you put them all together, you've got lots of packages that don't create costs, a lot of money to stimulate. You know, why does it so hard for the government to turn around and give a little to achieve so much? And let's not forget that when we put those mines in and when we put those railways in under Vogel and Seddon, that took a huge amount of infrastructural capital, which New Zealand has been getting the benefits of for the last 120 years. So why not give a little bit now in return for all what we had got from the West Coast so much since then?
Well, that's just it. You see, years ago there was a good mayor we had, Barry Dallas, and what he wanted to do was he wanted to put a minor levy on everything that was left the West Coast. We're only talking about 5 or 10 cents. Had they have done that, we would have had millions and millions of dollars now, because they've mothballed Spring Creek mine. So that's in what you call maintenance. So 300 or 400 people or more, I think, lost their jobs there. if we had have had this little pot of money set aside, we could have actually pulled that back in to things like Spring Creek and developed their own industries for times like this.
And not only mention that was, you know, that would have been a good opportunity to put forward a rescue package, and maybe that's something that the West Coasters need to look at themselves, is setting up, you know, a small a fund which, by putting into top 500, Fortune 500 companies, will build up over time, so that, God forbid, that there is another disaster in the future, that you've actually already got a capital stock fund. Because we've learned nothing from this event. It's don't wait for your government to come and help you, because they won't. And if you've ended up with this package, and really, then it's protecting the generations to come. And again, as we're seeing from the Nikki Haga situation, you know, the world's international media are jumping into him, and he's going to have a very large legal fund, and it's going to be really fun to watch that case, because basically the government's going to be facing a small division of legal black belts. And this is what, you know, we need to do. We don't need a lot to begin with, but put that money in to begin with, invested in those Fortune 500 companies, and over time you've got a very large stock for this sort of thing. And you know, that's the situation. We're learning from this stuff is that we have to start working together and doing it ourselves, because our governments are not, whether it's Labor or National, just let us down time and time again.
Well, that's right. So when the Coasters found out that Solid Energy paid about $7 million for the mine, many of the Coasters said if they'd have known it was going that cheap, they would have actually fronted up the money to buy the damn mine themselves. We wouldn't be in this problem we got now.
Well, that is a very good point, and it's interesting because, you know, overseas in places like Argentina, this is what's actually happened, is the workforces have actually come in, they've bought or requisitioned their own factories. The government has eventually had to recognise that actually that it is their property. And subsequently, because they're working for themselves, what's happened is safety has increased, productivity has increased, and, of course, that basically builds a future for the people. And, you know, it's one of those things which I'm really interested to see about the West Coast, because on one level you've got people that have got great endurance and that are real number eight, you know, they can think outside the fence. They can endure in any environment, but sometimes I feel West Coast, the biggest problem with West Coast is their very independence is what stops them from getting together and actually being a little bit more of a tour de force, which they could be if they wanted to.
Well, yeah, and the fact that as far as parliamentary votes go, the West Coast represents, you know, one or two seats. I mean, we've got the Mary seat and we've got our local MP, Damien O'Connor, who does a great job. So really, there's only two seats compared to the rest of the country, like Auckland, which, you know, if you upset people up there, then you're going to pay for it in the poll. So I guess in a way that the West Coast is politically expedient, I guess is the word you would use.
You're pretty much right. That's, you know, why Barry, you know, that's why Whale Walking can get away with saying things like West Coast ferals. But, you know, it's also the issue of when we've seen this move towards super cities with John Banks, and if you look at collectively for what's happening in local councils, we're seeing a centralisation of power so that Wellington actually has more say in our day-to-day lives. And the end result is that when you go into Parliament, of course, you're looking at 120 politicians, of which the greatest share come from the North Island. So when it comes to, who are we going to, what are we going to discuss in Parliament today? Where are we going to spend our money? Increasingly, the South Island is getting left out. And, you know, we see this down here in Dunedin with shutdown of Hillside Engineering. Instead, we bring in trains from overseas. We've had 13 derailments, and that's, I stopped checking then, but we've had 13 derailments in the last 12 months, all from basically faulty manufactured trains. We are closing down Invermay, which has got a huge history behind it, and we're going to lose some really top-class scientists, and we're going to move that up to the North Island. So what we're seeing more, and of course, you know, Tiwai Point again, like, you know, we've had 30 years to actually work something out on Tiwai Point, but instead it just gets used as a bargaining tool so that, again, these energy companies can get more and more money. And actually what I saw today was that now the energy companies are saying that if you use solar power, that you're taking it off the grid. This is going to push up electricity powers. And overseas, what they're saying is that in Florida, they've actually banned, you're not allowed to be off the grid. You have to use the state's electricity or energy at their prices. And, of course, if we sign the the TPPA, I'm a little dyslexic there, the TPPA, this is what we can expect. We can expect, no, you can't create safety for the mines, because that will actually breach mining, overseas miners will actually feel that it puts them at a disadvantage, so they'll sue us. You won't be able to turn around and shut down things because they're no longer expedient for the national energy or for the national interests. No, because again, that'll cost the company's profits, so they'll sue us. You won't be able to say, no, we don't want to use 1080 anymore because, no, the companies will sue us. We're basically getting ourselves in a situation where central government is actually going to make all the decisions, and they're going to be doing it on behalf of companies that don't care about our safety and don't care about our welfare.
Well, yeah, it's a corporate takeover of New Zealand. There's no other way to describe it.
Pretty much all. And I think, you know, this is what people have to think about. And this is what, you know, when you – Pike River may seem like a long way away from that issue, but the reality is that if we had the people of the West Coast – I mean, this also goes back to an environmental issue. If we had the people of the West Coast actually controlling their own minds, that would – you would actually end up with a situation where it means that 100% of the royalties – actually get returned to the people who do the mining, which in turn means that we don't have to mine as much, which means that we actually can be environmentally a lot better citizens. So this applies to our oil as well. I mean, we know that New Zealand's got huge amounts of oil. Well, why not actually leave it in the ground, actually have it so that we develop our own fund based on that oil, we use it to collect or raise investors. We actually mine it ourselves. We keep the royalty, so we don't have to open up 42 or how many offshore deep sea drills it is. Instead, we can open up two in shallow waters, create a very sustainable environment, and make money. So, I mean, this is a case where this whole situation where the divide and conquer between, oh no, if you're pro mining, you can't be love the environment, is ridiculous. There are solutions, but we, the people, need to actually start stepping outside those laws and actually say, well, what are you going to do? Arrest us all?
Yeah, and that about sums it up. As Vinnie Eastwood said, it's a scumbaggery of it all, because we've got all of these, we've got all these groups sort of, on one level, most people would laugh to find that actually sometimes the greenies and the miners actually get on well together. There are things we can agree on, like, for example, there are things we disagree on, like the safest way to do Pike River is to actually open cast it. Now, I've been to the mine itself. Where it is, tourists don't generally go. So to open cast it where it is, it wouldn't actually matter.
Let's step back from that one, because I want to go with your first point, because, you know, I'll be up front. I'm not a big fan of open cast mining, but I want to go back to the point that you just turned around and said about how greenies and miners have got a lot in common, because my feeling, and I'm going to jump a wee bit to what's happened in Ragland, is my feeling is that when you get people that actually have got different interests but common loves, if you sit them in the same room, you find that eventually if you concentrate on the common ground, you can find a solution which both parties will actually go, yep, that gets us what we want. We're both in it, satisfaction, let's do it. And this is what's happened in Ragland with the Kiwis against seabed mining, is that what you've actually seen is the people involved in environmentalism, people involved in tourism, people involved in the dairy industry, people involved in the fishing industry have all got together because they've all recognised that this is bad for Ragland, and they have collectively come up with a cohesive action. Now, along the way, and this is where I think we get the situation with open class mining, along the way, what's actually also happened is that environmentalists have suddenly find themselves sitting in the same room with fishermen, and for the first time ever, the fishermen get to explain to them what their whole issue is with, say, something like the Maui dolphins. So the environmentalists go, oh, I hadn't considered that. Oh, well, now that I know that, then maybe this is the solution. And then the fishermen go, actually, you're right, that could work. And I suspect that's a little bit like the open cast mining situations, that we put all these situations together, we might say, well, actually, we do this and we don't need to do that. But that still, at the end of the day, puts money on the table. And that's really what we're all about, is seeing how we can put money on the table without having to damage this existing asset. Do you think that's a fair analogy?
Yeah, and I'll give you one good example of that. And that's the fishermen on the West Coast. They used to throw back a lot of bycatch because your net just picks it up. So when you got it, it's generally, you know, you throw it back.
Yeah.
But because a lot of it dies, they're actually now to keep it.
Yeah.
So they're actually making good money off the bycatch.
So So
it is a sensible way to go. What's the point of throwing dead product back just to rot and die?
Well, you know, I think you're completely correct, and I think this is basically applies to many of these issues, is that when you actually, if we can stop that divide and conquer, and we can get the people together and say, look, what is the common ground that let's start off with what is the common ground, and then work backwards, you end up with a solution. And that's what I think people need to focus on, and I think they all need to collectively apply the pressure. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take your letter about calling for the guys to go there I'm going to put it on my Facebook page. I'm going to tag it. That's going to reach an audience of about 6,000. If I can get you to do the same thing, Graham, it's going to reach a similar audience. And if anyone's out there and they've got that on their Facebook, share it as well, because the more that we work together, the better results we can. That's where the whole concept of gung-ho comes from, many hands working together. Graham, I'm just going to say thank you very much. Graham Axford, thank you very much for coming on the show. Is there anything last 10 seconds you've got? Do you want to add in?
Oh, I just want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to do this.
My absolute pleasure. And I said, you know, I'm going to keep coming back and looking at this whole electrical issue equipment. But until next time, you are on the Postman Show. You can find the click links on the website to thevinnyeastwood.com, www.thevinnyeastwood.com. If you like what you're hearing, please donate to the cause, because this makes it all possible. And my biggest thing at the moment is I need a new smartphone so that I can do this with a lot more ease than I'm currently doing. So once again, thank you very much. And until next time, good night and good luck.